Hi all, welcome to History of Asia. Last episode was one long introduction to this one, so without further ado, here comes my take on the life, work and death of Alexander the Great and the fall of Achaemenid Persia. Now this is in many ways a story of David and Goliath. Just like his hero Achilles, Alexander hailed from a backwater, Macedonia. But Persia, on the other hand, was the biggest empire that the world had ever seen. And depending on your definition, it could even be seen as the first empire ever. During Alexander's youth, it was even ruled by a very capable but vicious ruler, Artaxerxes III. Not only had that guy reorganized the state, he had also retaken Egypt, which had been independent for some time. In the halls of his palace in Persepolis, the King of Kings witnessed all his subject peoples bringing tokens of submission. Just look up a picture of its ruins and you will be in no doubt that whoever held audience there must have felt like the king of the world. If there was anyone at all that he feared, it surely was not a foreign power. True, the Greeks had warded off a Persian invasion more than 100 years before, often portrayed as the salvation of Western civilization. But in reality, that victory, if it can be called that at all, came at a heavy price. Along with 300 of his countrymen, the Spartan king Leonidas was actually butchered at Thermopylae. His head was placed on a spike. Athens would be burned to the ground, along with other city-states. The main reason, then, that the Persians hastened back home after a few setbacks was that there were disturbances closer to their heartland. Greece wasn't worth the trouble then. In fact, the Persians found better ways of keeping them busy. They encouraged them to fight among themselves. They funded whoever appeared to be the weaker party in Greece. And this way, the Persians fueled the Peloponnesian War, the same way that America kept the war between Iran and Iraq going. For a very long time, it worked brilliantly. Sparta, Athens, Thebes, and the other Greek powers were kept busy and dependent on Persian support. Many were still entertaining fantasies of revenge, but these were merely pipe dreams, and it was unthinkable that any one of them would ever act on these. Least of all, Macedon, where Alexander was born as son of King Philip II. Macedonia was a poor and turbulent place on the fringes of Greek civilization. Despite the fact that they had much in common with other Hellenes in terms of language, religion, and culture, they were hardly regarded as fellow Greeks. It is telling, for instance, that until shortly before, they had even been barred from competing in the Olympics. Civilized Greeks didn't want to associate themselves with these uncultured semi-barbarians. This was given an ironic twist of late. I don't know if you heard, but until just a few years ago, there was a row between the modern state of Greece and its northern neighbor, then known as Macedonia. The latter emerged on the world scene after the breakup of Yugoslavia in the early 90s. Greeks were angry about the chosen name of this new state because they claimed that Macedonia was part of Greece, belonged to Greece. Now, to outsiders, this may sound almost childish, but the dispute was serious enough to have profound consequences. It risked blocking Macedonia's accession to the European Union and NATO, so the stakes were pretty high. Encouraged by other nations, in 2018, the leftist Syriza government finally closed a deal with its northern counterpart. Henceforth, Macedonia would change its name to North Macedonia. Even that did not satisfy most Greeks, however. Nationalists protested fanatically. And it's not as if they didn't have more important things on their mind at that time. Greece was forced to swallow brutal austerity measures to alleviate its debt crisis. The irony is, of course, that while today's Greeks frantically claim Macedonia for themselves, in the time before Alexander, they didn't want anything to do with it. The fact that this changed still has everything to do with Alexander, and to a lesser degree, his father Philip. They saved Greece from its internal feuds, forcing them to unite behind them and against Persia. Alexander would conquer the entire Persian Empire, turning the Greeks into the masters of the universe. Some of them, anyway. he would be the one to finally exact bloody revenge for the burning of Athens, which was a bit rich. For guess where Alexander's ancestors were when Greece was under attack? Fighting on the enemy's side. And to complete the irony, the Macedonian leader, who then decided to make common cause with the Persians, was also called Alexander. Macedon would remain under Persian influence for a long time, and this may partly explain why Macedonia still had a king, for this had gone totally out of fashion in the more civilized Greek city-states. There, it was regarded as a practice from mythical times, indeed, from the time of the Iliad, a fact that Alexander could use in his propaganda. If the good old days were back, if kings once again behaved like Homeric heroes, then it was time for Greeks to accept the return of the king. Important side note, the fact that Macedonia had a king, that didn't necessarily mean that it was more hierarchical than the city-states to its south. The term king can be misleading, given the connotations most of us attach to that word. When we think of a king, we think of someone who rules by the grace of God. And indeed, Macedonian monarchs traced their lineage back to the gods. There was a royal family. Not any politician could become king. In that sense, it was a monarchy, as we would understand it. But at the same time, this king was merely a first among equals. Macedonia had few resources, which meant not a big surplus that could be used for social stratification. The barons provided troops, but in return, they demanded respect and expected to have a say in the affairs of state. The king had to wine and dine them, and during these drunken feasts, they weren't supposed to hold back their tongues. After all, the freedom to speak their minds was what separated them from the slaves of the East, or so they saw it. In that regard, their mindset was not so dissimilar to that of democratic-minded Athenians. Philip, Alexander's father, would slowly start to change this. He captured rich territories, some of which contained silver mines, and then he used these new resources to buy more influence. To escape the status of parvenu, he tried to appear as cultured as he could. He sponsored all sorts of prestigious projects, also in other city-states, and he hired a respected thinker like Aristotle as tutor for his kid. Now, of course, people would still snigger behind his back, but less and less in his face. And that had more to do with the fact, perhaps, that he created a formidable standing army. He started behaving ever more like a true monarch. Doesn't seem far-fetched to think that Persia may have served as an example for him. Now, just because he felt that the time was ripe for a more hierarchical form of government, that didn't mean his subordinates thought the same way. His commanders were used to a situation in which they could set aside the king if they deemed it to their interests. They were not ready to throw themselves on the floor in submission anytime soon. The court remained a treacherous environment, a true snake pit. When a few decades later, these same people would get to rule much of the known world, they would still take these mauls with them. The difference was that their petty rivalries then implicated the lives of millions of people. The successor kingdoms of the Diadochi would be nearly as fragile as the court of Philip II. The weaker the position of the state, the more precarious the position of its king. And when Philip II, Alexander's father, came to power, Macedon was in dire straits indeed. Divided internally, and at the point of being carved up by aggressive neighbors. Miraculously, Philip turned it into the hegemon of Greece. This is not the place to delve deeply into how he did it, but it's worth mentioning one thing, I think, his army. Because this was in essence the same army that his son would use to conquer the Persian Empire with. Its most striking features were the intensive use of heavy cavalry and the revolutionary use of the phalanx. His infantrymen were highly disciplined and held lances of up to 6 meters long. This meant that no less than 4 ranks of men could at once point their lethal weapons at an advancing enemy. Attacking such a giant porcupine must have felt like suicide. The fact that the men were shoulder to shoulder also had the additional advantage that most were prevented from running away, and that was crucial, for panic was often the cause of defeat in ancient wars. not hard to see why, if you consider how nasty hand-to-hand combat truly is. It may look relatively benign in video games, but it literally comes down to chopping and stabbing another person to pieces, or having it done to you. Just imagine the thought of getting a spear right through your gut or your eye, being trampled as you lay dying. Blah, not my cup of tea. Running away at that point would not be a sign of cowardice, I think, just a normal human instinct. If you could somehow prevent your men from running in such circumstances, that was a huge bonus. Finally, what made the Macedonian army so nasty was the fact that it was used so much. Both the rank and file and their commanders grew accustomed to actual combat. The Spartans were supposed to be training for war all the time, but as any veteran will tell you, there is a big difference between practicing and the real thing. Philips had lots of professional troops that he made sure were fighting someone every year. And meanwhile, other city-states still depended on amateur militias. By extension, battle experience was something that many Persian troops would lack also. When Alexander invaded, large parts of the Persian Empire hadn't seen such fighting for a long time. In fact, the Persians had in a way spurred on the professionalization of Greek warfare by encouraging and funding strife between city-states. This made the Greeks in general good fighters, and they were therefore sought out as mercenaries, especially by the Persians, who could afford to let others do the fighting for them. Persian subjects were themselves disarmed, so that the keeping of internal order could be accomplished by a small specialized group of soldiers. In a way, the Persians would become victims of their own successful divide-and-rule strategies, you might say. By the end of Philip's reign, not only was Macedon fully accepted as part of Greek civilization, it had become its hegemon, as I said, and that naturally bred discontent in city-states that traditionally claimed that position for themselves, like Athens. But they were too fearful and weak to stand up to him. However, the king had a problem. Part of his strategy throughout had been to reward loyalty and punish disloyalty, taking from enemies, giving to friends. But once all of Greece was loyal, he then theoretically had to reward everyone. Who was he going to take that money from? He now had more money flowing in than ever, but it was merely enough to cover the running costs of his political machine. Lucky for Philip, though, there lay a giant empire just around the corner, whose riches were legendary. Persia, of course. What's more, the Persians were bent on using that money to undermine the recent unity among the Greeks, as they had continually done since the failed invasion of Xerxes. Many of the patriots who pushed the Persians out of Greece even ended up in their service. The divide and rule now failed, thanks to Philip, but only for the time being. The only thing needed to make the Greeks go at it again was that their uniter should leave the scene. Not impossible if you have an endless supply of bribes and a huge network of infiltrators. So although Philip is seen as a super aggressive warlord set on conquest, looked at from this angle, he had no choice. He had a small window of opportunity, and if he didn't use that momentum to take care of Persia, it would surely take care of him. And maybe the Persians did get to him first. For Philip was stabbed to death, of all places, at the very feast where he would announce the attack on Asia. In front of everybody. Poison would have been much easier and safer, I presume, but the upside of this dramatic murder was the message that it sent. Every possible new leader was present to witness firsthand what happened to people who defied Persia. Had the assassin been paid by Persian gold? Very well possible. And if they were behind it, then it looks strikingly like how the later assassins discouraged everyone from declaring war on them. Remember that? Now, the most popular theory is that there were more personal motives at play. The killer was one of Philip's own bodyguards, and he would have acted out of spite, presumably. The man had apparently been gang-raped by an ally of the king, named Attalus. Philip had refused to do anything about it, because Attalus was so important. After all, punishing his allies, that was not part of his strategy. So for the later assassin, murdering the king may have been payback, perhaps a way to win back his honor. Or he may have been used as a tool by someone else who played upon his anger and shame. The Persians? Perhaps, but it's hard to bribe someone into committing suicide, which is what this came down to. Indeed, there was someone else who stood to profit from this, Alexander. He was the heir to Philip, but for how much longer? Shortly before, he had fallen out with his father. At one of these drunken soirees, a baron had insinuated that Alexander was not a proper successor, as his mother Olympias was not Macedonian, she was from Epirus. To Alexander's alarm, no doubt, Philips didn't stand up for him. Angrily, and perhaps afraid, the prince and his mother then reclused themselves back in Epirus. There are signs that things got back to normal after a while, but perhaps Alexander or Olympias, or both, decided they'd better get Philips out of the way now, before he would change his mind about the succession. What supports this viewpoint, at least I think, is that the baron who insulted Alexander happens to be the same Attalus who supposedly organized the gang rape of Philip's assassin. This Attalus was clearly a staunch enemy of Alexander's and of the man who killed Philip. Needless to say, the story about the gang rape could have been concocted after the fact. It's a fascinating whodunit, but one thing is certain, it was Alexander who ended up profiting the most. With the help of other barons like Parmenio and Antipater, he took the throne. And then, never waste a good crisis, he started accusing his rivals of conspiracy in his father's murder, and he started executing them one by one. First on the list, Attalus. The man that the killer had supposedly been so angry with that it drove him to murder the king, instead of Attalus. But Alexander didn't think that was so odd, and he also didn't find it contradictory to heap the same accusation upon Persia. They were complicit in his father's death, and he would avenge him. And while he was at it, he would also make the Persians pay for their invasion of Greece more than a century before. Matter of keeping the other Greeks involved too, no doubt. The irony was that when a few city-states took advantage of the situation to revolt, Alexander reacted no less viciously than the Persians had against Athens. Thebes was completely burned to the ground. Alexander had made his point, and now everyone fell into line. Alexander, like his father, understood that he had no time to waste. Willy-nilly, all the Greeks were going on a great adventure. And what an adventure it would be. In many ways, a repetition of the Iliad. And to make sure everyone noticed that, Alexander would visit places that figured in those famous tales to pay his respects to the heroes of ancient Greece. It's hard to tell what the Greeks would have thought about this. At first, their enthusiasm may have been tempered, but many of the noble youth of the allied city-states had to join the campaign. They would make great hostages in case the politicians of their hometown were thinking about rebelling once Alexander disappeared over the horizon. But in time, as the unlikely victories would pile up, the dynamic changed. It became ever clearer that they were taking part in one of the most glorious adventures of all world history, making their city proud. It was equally clear that they had Alexander to thank for that. So the city-states had little choice but to attach their own honor and fortune to him and his descendants, although in some cases with gnashing teeth. And then I wonder what the Persians would have made of this. Surely they must have thought that, with the uniquely qualified Philip out of the way, the quarrelsome Greeks and Macedonians would soon be at each other's throats again. They could hardly have imagined that his son would prove even more capable of uniting and leading them. As I said in the last episode, I still find that quite puzzling myself. How lucky can you get, really? On the other hand, the Persian leadership had other worries. Around the same time that Philip was killed, so was Artaxerxes III, the uber-capable king of kings. What's more, he had murdered most of his family to forestall coups, and so he was followed by his inexperienced young son, who'd also not be long for this world. He was murdered by the same eunuch who killed his father, and who then brought a nobleman to power as Darius III. Darius was not secure in his position either, and his main preoccupation would have been not getting whacked himself. Even as Alexander took over his father's quest and crossed the Dardanelles, there was still no reason for the Persians to panic. The King of Kings simply outsourced the task of dealing with this nuisance to a local satrap. That was not a sign of condescension, as it is often portrayed. He had no choice, as the local satrap was the only one who could get an army on the spot quickly enough. We have to realize the sheer vastness of the Persian Empire and the logistical and other practical complexities of bringing troops from A to B. Besides, there was little reason to think the satrap wouldn't be able to deal with this. He could enlist thousands of Greek mercenaries for the job, for instance, and who would be better at fighting Greeks than other Greeks? To give you an idea, estimates vary, of course, but Alexander's army at this point may have numbered about 40,000 infantry and 6,000 cavalry, comparable to a decent-sized football stadium, and the forces of the satrap would have been comparable in size. It may have been a close-run thing, but Alexander came out victorious. Well done. But no miracles needed to explain this, I think. But at this point in the story, that is about to change. For now, the King of Kings decides to take matters into his own hands. Departing from his winter palace in Babylon, he marched towards the invader with a huge army, perhaps twice the size of the Macedonian one. But what would happen if it came face to face with the invader? In 333 at Issos, they found out. It seems that the Persian King of Kings put his troops in formation between the coast and the mountains. The problem with that would be that this way he could not fully exploit his numerical advantage. And even more consequential was the position of the king's own chariot in the middle of the second line of troops. His visible presence there was probably intended to give his men courage, but it also made him a tempting target. And according to the story, that is what decides the battle. Alexander's elite cavalry charged through the Persian ranks, straight toward the now exposed King of Kings, who at that point turns his chariot around and rushes away to safety. If true, that must have been devastating for Persian morale. Many panicked and fled, others surrendered, still others retreated. It was a disaster, but it sounds as if it might have gone another way, if only the King of Kings had showed more courage. Should he have stood his ground? Perhaps, but if he had been killed, then all would have been lost then and there. Now at least he had the chance to fight another day. This reminds me, you will be surprised, of a scene in Game of Thrones. A queen intends to go fight in person. After all, she asks, what kind of ruler would stay behind while others fight on her behalf? Her advisor knows the answer, a smart one. And not just for her sake, it takes only one stray arrow and it will all be for naught. Likewise, it could be argued, I think, that for Darius, fleeing was not really the mistake, it was being present in the first place. It's natural to contrast the supposed flight of Darius to the bravado of Alexander the Great, who allegedly fought in the vanguard at all times, including in this battle. He would have enjoyed the action and welcomed the danger. But if fleeing from harm is common sense for Darius, then what to make of Alexander's ferociousness? If you are the king, you are in the front lines, clearly visible, and any opponent knows killing you means instantly ending the war and becoming a hero. Well, I can't imagine anyone survive that for 10 minutes. Every arrow, every spear is going to be aimed at him, correct? Thousands of them. No wonder that Darius would retreat when he got exposed. Since Alexander, on the contrary, doesn't suffer a fatal wound in any of all these battles, while he supposedly acted as the tip of the spear, well, frankly, I very much doubt whether any of this happened at all then. I think it's important to remember at this point that as the eventual victor, Alexander could to a large degree decide how history would be written. He, and of course the successor kings who prided themselves on their connection to him. The least you can say is that it fits the ideal of Homeric kingship he wanted to spread. And as for his opponent fleeing like a coward, well, if you're about to lay claim to that guy's throne, you might want to spread a story like this, wouldn't you? But fair is fair. The grave of Alexander's father has probably been found, and researchers have investigated the remains. and he does bear all the marks of fighting in war. It was known that he lost an eye, and so did Alexander's commander Antigonus One Eye, and so did many other kings before modernity. So if all these guys could get maimed in battle, well, why not Alexander himself? I suppose being near the battle was in itself dangerous. You could always be struck by an arrow, people would be aiming at you, right? So would Alexander have suffered a wound from time to time? Probably. But was he suicidally brave, as the sources make him out to be? My humble opinion? Less likely. But I get the feeling I'm almost alone in my skepsis, so best not listen to me. Now, what all this at least makes clear is how precarious Alexander's eventual victory was. One arrow, one sword blow could have ended the whole enterprise. We know that because when he eventually did die, his whole empire collapsed overnight. Had that happened in the beginning of the war, well. Issus was, of course, a fiasco for Darius. And to make the personal drama even worse, his family, who were with him on campaign apparently, fell into the enemy's hands. The King of Kings would plead in vain to get them back, even offering territorial concessions in return, to no avail. In return for peace, Alexander could even call himself king of all the lands he had so far conquered. After one such offer, his right-hand man, Parmenio, allegedly said that he would take that deal if he were Alexander. To which Alexander is supposed to have replied, "I'd do that too, if I were you," which sounds suspiciously similar to his conversation with the cynic Diogenes that we mentioned in the last episode. Instead of following Parmenio's advice, Alexander wrote to Darius that he should come to him personally and submit. There are more such anecdotes about the older Parmenio giving prudent advice, Alexander shoving it aside, and then being proven right. Now, in theory, this may have happened, but it sounds a lot like something Alexander's propaganda would want people to believe. It's like in so many detective series, where a lousy sidekick vainly suggests that the hero work by the book, and thereby making it clear just how unorthodox and daring his methods actually are. By playing that role in this story, Parmenio comes across as an incompetent and a coward, and Alexander as the brave visionary. But we have to keep in mind that this Parmenio had already been right-hand man to Philip and then to Alexander. It would be ridiculous to think he was anything but a very fine general. Perhaps he was even the real brain behind much of the glory. After all, he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth to the extent that Alexander was. He was more a product of meritocracy. In fact, along with Antipater, he played a key role in securing the throne for Alexander. He would in time be poorly rewarded for that loyalty, as we will yet see, and the defilement of his reputation was perhaps just adding insult to injury. After Issos, the tables had turned. By abandoning the fight, Darius has lost face, his family, his giant army, lots of territory, and not unimportantly, his royal baggage train representing a lot of money and therefore influence. But he still had the chance to muster another army in the important eastern satrapies. That would take time, however, which gave Alexander the opportunity to first take care of some other urgent business. First of all, to deal with the Persian fleet. Persian empires rarely had good navies, but this one was the exception, and the reason was that the Achaemenids could count upon the services of seafaring peoples, and especially the Phoenicians, who lived in city-states around present-day Lebanon. Now, this fleet hadn't been able to stop Alexander from crossing the Dardanelles. That would have been impossible, since rowing vessels couldn't remain in the water for a long time, waiting until Alexander decided to cross. But the fleet remained a problem for Alexander nonetheless, most of all because it enabled the Persians to threaten Greece and forcing him to return. Alexander didn't have a fleet of his own that could match theirs, so instead he dealt with them by taking their ports. The tactic worked brilliantly, and after a while, it seems that the Phoenician fleet simply fell apart. As a consequence, the Persians couldn't take the war to Greece, or effectively help rebels there. There would be only one notable revolt in Greece during Alexander's campaigns, under the leadership of Sparta, one of these old power centers now past their prime, it would be easily crushed by Antipater, the loyalist that Alexander left in charge of Macedon. Alexander knew that Darius would need time to muster a new army, so he used that time to conquer Egypt with all its riches. The local satrap surrendered without resistance, which probably had a lot to do with the fact that Egypt had successfully rebelled against the Persians and had only just been retaken by Artaxerxes III. When ancient kings dealt with rebels, they became particularly nasty, and not without reason. They didn't have a big enough standing army to occupy all these lands, so there was only one thing to stop these provinces from declaring independence again once the army had left, making clear that horrendous reprisals would surely follow if they rebelled again. So when Darius's predecessor finally retook Egypt, he started doling out terrible punishments. We can imagine that 10 years later, Egypt would still be seething. It was a perfect time for a challenger to appear. Alexander found it easy to make friends with the Egyptian priesthood and nobility. He was formally crowned pharaoh with all the accompanying godly titles. As part of the deal, he helpfully presented himself as a friend of their gods, and particularly Amon, whom the Greeks accepted as an incarnation of Zeus. That's the beauty of polytheism, you know. A strange god could simply be recognized as another name or form of one's own god. The idea may have been to show to the locals that their gods wanted Alexander to come, especially after the horrible things that the Persians had done in recent history. Ironically, the Persian founding father Cyrus, also nicknamed the Great, would have acted in a very similar fashion, as did his son Cambyses when he took over Egypt for the first time. It's likely, I think, that Alexander was aware of that. That is the cynical interpretation. But it has also been suggested that the manipulation went in the other direction. The Egyptian priests may have convinced Alexander that he was the son of Zeus Amon, something that he may have suspected anyway, considering those rumors about his mother and the snake. Something may have happened back in Egypt that set him on the path toward believing in his own divinity. Perhaps he already entertained ideas of being a demigod. Then at least his reception in Egypt cannot have helped sober his mind. It's perhaps telling that in Egypt he founded his city, Alexandria, the first of many. The Greeks sometimes named their towns after a god, but never after a living man. Alexander's motifs remain obscure, but what is clear is that his generals grew more and more annoyed with his so-called Oriental attitude. They remembered a time, not that long ago, when they were treated almost as equals by their king. Now, by expecting a more deferential treatment, they felt Alexander was going local. And later generations of historians have also looked at it this way. It's typical for great civilizations like Persia to conquer, in a cultural way, the people who conquered them by the sword. Yet this is only partly true in this case. For although the Persians did bow before their kings, they didn't consider them divine. But Egyptians did, and by the time the Seleucids were done with them, so would the Persians and the other peoples in the successor states. As he returned from Egypt, Alexander's victory was still by no means assured. The Persian King of Kings had used his time well, and he had assembled another huge army. How large exactly is impossible to say, but some historians reckon it must have been around 80,000 men, because anything above that number would be practically unmanageable with the logistical means available at that time. Now, if this is true, then that means this was not just the largest army in the world, it was the largest possible army. So now everything was set for the final confrontation, an epoch-defining battle that would take place on the plains near Gaugamela, the Iranian town after which the battle would be named. Darius's generals had done their homework. They learned a thing or two from their earlier encounters with the Macedonians. They had, for instance, come to understand that much of the Greek strength lay in the phalanx. When used well, it was almost invincible, but it had one Achilles heel, if you'll pardon the pun. If their formation was disrupted, if the men failed to stay shoulder to shoulder, then everything would collapse. So that's what the Persians tried to do, in multiple ingenious ways. Most of all, they used lots of chariots with large scissors or sword attached to the wheels, Ben-Hur style. Sounds disruptive enough. Just imagine having to stand your ground when faced with such a meat chopper. And to make sure that this cutting machine would operate smoothly, the Persians even had the ground flattened, cleared of all obstacles. There were even some elephants brought in, apparently, to create chaos in the Greeks' ranks. It all sounds like a pretty good idea to me, but apparently it didn't work. The lines held firm. Confronted with the pincushion of spears, the Persian horses flinched. They were instinctively looking for an exit then, and so they could be lured towards the openings in the ranks that the Greeks left there on purpose. They let the chariots pass through and then cut them down from the back. Now, I assure you, this all sounds much easier than it is. You would need nerves of steel, a perfect sense of timing and discipline, or the trap would fail. The same technique was probably applied to the elephants, who were too few to make a real difference. They are even ignored in the sources, to be honest. Perhaps if the Persians had more opportunities to experiment, or if they could have used more elephants, like the later Seleucids would, that might have changed the outcome. In the end, however, the second big battle was supposedly decided the exact same way as the first one. Alexander, in front of his personal guard, charged directly into the enemy lines, straight towards the King of Kings, who turns around and runs, for the second straight time. Needless to say, he gets blamed for this cowardice. But to be fair, even if this is true at all, and I kind of doubt it, even then, whether this was cowardice all depends a bit on how close the enemies were, no? Of course, that sort of nuance wouldn't interest Alexander and his admirers. If we want to get an impression of the personality of Darius, there are a few indications, the best being how he came to power in the first place. Though he was of blue blood, he was not a prince himself. Artaxerxes III had murdered all members of his family that he considered dangerous, and apparently the later Darius was not among them, which may be telling. It would seem that he was later put on the throne by a eunuch called Bagoas, who had first murdered Artaxerxes III and then murdered his son, which would imply that the eunuch also saw the later Darius as a pliable character. But perhaps both Bagoas and Artaxerxes had underestimated him. For when Bagoas reportedly tried to get rid of him, Darius found out and forced him to drink the poison himself. It's important to note that we have this info from a Greek source. It may say more about Greek presumptions about Persian kings and eunuchs, and perhaps about Darius in particular, than about what actually happened. For what it's worth, it's also been rumored that Artaxerxes had earlier given the later King Darius a promotion as a reward for his bravery. That seems to contradict the other accounts about him, wouldn't you say? But then, saying that someone is brave or cowardly is nearly always a simplification. It's perfectly possible to be brave one instant and instinctively run away the next, I think, especially if you find yourself in the position of Darius at Issus and Gaugamela, and you see a mass of fierce warriors coming for you. Running away may have been the least bad option. If he doesn't do it, does the battle take another turn? Does history turn on the instinct of one man? Many have claimed as much, but I guess we will never know that for certain. All we know is that Alexander will win this war, and that he and his successors get to decide how posterity remembers the event. After Gaugamela, it was clear to anyone that Alexander was going to win this thing. He marched into the Persian winter palace at Babylon, which he took without opposition. A little wonder, I think, for the Babylonians could also see from where the wind was blowing. It's probable that he was indeed welcomed as a savior. What would you do, given the circumstances? They knew what happened to those cities that, like Tyre, refused to surrender. In return for their submission, once again, the Babylonians got basically the same deal as under the Persians. Their new ruler acted as a Babylonian king and honored Babylon's gods. The Persian satrap of Babylon, even though he had earlier faced Alexander in battle even, was reaffirmed in his position. So at first sight, Alexander did manage to pose as a liberator. But talk is cheap. For most people living through this liberation, it must have all have felt quite differently. Early on, Alexander had already made a big fuss about liberating the Greek cities in Asia Minor. But even for those people, the most important thing that changed was that they would now pay their taxes to Alexander. Even though these taxes were presented as voluntary gifts to the cause. Further inland, it got worse. Alexander sent his fleet home so he could no longer rely on it for carrying food and supplies. The upkeep of his army would therefore fall squarely on the people that were unfortunate enough to be in his path, and not giving all they had would likely be regarded as sabotage. The passing of his army had the effect of a cloud of locusts. I don't imagine it felt like much of a liberation. Nonetheless, this is how, in modern times, Alexander's conquests have often been described by Europeans. The decadent Persian tyrants were thrown out, and the rich Greek culture would now breathe new life into the tired East. It would become an inspiration, and even a justification for later European colonizations. Since he now considered himself the king of Asia, the Asians were now Alexander's subjects, and his responsibility, therefore. So he could hardly let his troops ransack at will. At the very least, that would make ruling more difficult. So he tried to hold them back as well as he could. But they were still expecting payment for their troubles. And don't forget, Alexander was not there on holiday, nor to become king of Asia. He had a mission, to avenge the Persian excursion into Greece more than 100 years earlier. His men felt like no one had yet been properly punished for that. But he was coming to that part. The army was now entering the Persian heartland, and there Alexander would put on a less friendly face. Even less friendly. In Susa, he confiscated the Persian royal treasure. The fact that he could unleash a big part of this onto the market would cause massive inflation. The real target of his just revenge, though, would be Persepolis. And that was fitting, for it was the capital built by Darius the Great, the first Persian king who had invaded Greece. When approaching this mighty city, the Greeks reportedly met other Greeks, who were said to be descendants of captives of those campaigns from a century earlier. They had been brutally mistreated and disfigured, and were now stomping about like zombies. Which would be pretty coincidental, if you ask me. It was clearly a justification for the orgy of violence that was about to inflict it upon Persepolis. The exact circumstances are disputed, but the palace was burned to the ground as punishment for the burning of Athens so long ago. Mission accomplished, you might think. And indeed, now that Greece had been avenged, Alexander did allow his Greek soldiers to return home if they so desired. This move shows his feel for PR, I think. It would ensure him a good press in the home country. Those that chose to return would surely boast of the wonders that they had achieved under his leadership. They were no longer likely to turn against him. Those that left were no doubt the least motivated to fight on anyway, and he could afford to let them go since his final victory was no longer in doubt, especially since his men soon caught up with Darius. He was found dead, most likely killed by the satrap that he had come to depend on. But this was still not the end of Alexander's ambitions. He was set to conquer the rest of the Persian Empire and beyond. Many Greeks and Macedonians were more than willing to go with him, for this was sure to be a highly profitable affair. The burning of Persepolis was a turning point for another reason too. Ominously, as the palace went up in flames, Alexander was asked why he would want to destroy his own property. Now that justice had been done, he stepped into the footsteps of his erstwhile enemy. He would in time give Darius a royal funeral with all the usual decorum. The implications of that were clear for any Persian. It was their tradition that any king of kings did this for his predecessor. Alexander would even marry Darius's daughter, and he also left many of the old arrangements intact, like the tried and tested system of satrapies. He clearly had no desire to destroy the Persian Empire. On the contrary, he was intent on becoming king of kings himself. Perhaps, we may speculate, This idea already existed even in the mind of Philip. Macedonia had long been under Persian influence, and it's not unusual for people of the periphery to want to take over the rich lands of the people that they supposedly despised for their decadence. Alexander even went so far as to vow to avenge the death of Darius, his predecessor, whom he had mocked and fought so fanatically. Pretty impressive U-turn, I'd say. He accused the satrap Bessos of killing Darius, and this now became his excuse for continuing the expansion further eastward. On his way, Alexander founded many cities that he again called Alexandria. These were pretty strategically placed and populated with the Greek Macedonian soldiers. Locals followed, and these places would become important cities like Herat and Kandahar in Afghanistan. It would serve as an example for the later Seleucids, who would found their own Seleucias and Antiochs, named after the rulers themselves. As Macedonia was disappearing into the distance, people began to see further change in Alexander. You have to keep in mind the way his proud people would look upon Persians, as decadent, corrupt, tyrannical, worshipping devils, evil qua. Now the man who had slain this demon was putting on the garb of a Persian king. He welcomed ever more of the devil's minions in his entourage. He married the devil's daughter, as well as a Sogdian princess called Roxanne. Eventually, he even began to insist that people greet him in the manner of an Eastern king, in other words, like their old enemies, slaves. To the Macedonian elite, this was shocking. As we've seen in the last episode, Alexander would come to blows over this with his erstwhile friend Cassander, which may well have led to his death. But we shouldn't doubt that many others were just as horrified, just too scared to say or do anything about it. For those who had dared to utter subtle criticism had been found guilty of this or that conspiracy and done away with. Against all odds, the hero had defeated the mighty demon. And just when it looked as though everything would be all right, he was clearly turning into that demon himself, not just in behavior, but even in appearance. I'll bet you could make a great movie about that, or perhaps a video game. Let's once again take a moment to notice the similarities with the later Arab takeover of Persia. The Sasanian King of Kings had also been a distant and semi-divine character, hiding his majesty behind a curtain and demanding that people kowtow before him. The early caliphs wouldn't dream of doing this. Indeed, their men mocked this relentlessly. Even the Umayyads still held court the old-fashioned way, approachable for common people. It was only under the Abbasids, centuries later, that the old customs revived. Alexander, typically, was not so prudent, and he did this straight away. If, say, Caliph Abu Bakr had done the same, rest assured, that would have been frowned upon. Now, although it was understandable that the old Macedonian barons had problems with their young king's growing megalomania, the soldiery didn't mind. They didn't think of their high commander as their equal anyway. This already shows signs of the major schism between the officers and the rank and file after Alexander's death. The commoners would stay loyal to his memory and kin, while the barons were more concerned with taking power themselves. When his father died, Alexander had already presided over some infamous purges. He was the heir, but Philip had other sons, and there were no guarantees that the barons would accept him. But his rivals were accused of complicity in Philip's murder and done away with. Now, when the great goal has been achieved, there will be another series of purges. And one of the more important victims was Alexander's old companion, Parmenio. He was left behind in the west to look after Alexander's affairs, perhaps a sign of the trust that he placed in him, although the fact that his son accompanied Alexander could be looked upon as some kind of insurance. This son, however, was now suspected of involvement in a plot to kill Alexander and duly executed. It was not so crazy to think that this might provoke Parmenio into rebellion, and Alexander really couldn't risk that. So the messenger, who brought his faithful ally the news of his son's execution, was instructed to kill him on the spot. A frighteningly cold-hearted thing to do, especially to one of your most loyal friends. This Parmenio is really an interesting character, I find. He had already worked his way up the ranks under Philip and had been his right-hand man. He had held the bridgehead in Asia Minor that would be the starting point for the invasion of the Persian Empire. He had arranged the execution of Attalus and so helped secure Alexander's rise to power, and he had played a key role in all the key battles. Despite the fact that later propaganda would portray him as too conservative and weak-minded, that is already a sign that there is something fishy about that portrayal, I think. He was part of the old guard that had made Macedonia great, perhaps the most capable of them even. It's not unthinkable that many of the leading lights would see him as the driving force behind Alexander's successes, that the new kid just picked the fruits of his expertise. If so, then that would explain why he had to die, and why his image would later be tarnished by portraying him as a mediocre commander, despite the responsibility that Alexander kept entrusting to him. Who knows, perhaps he or his son was indeed part of a plot to murder Alexander as this conflict was coming to a head. If anyone could do it, it was he. Again, we will never know, but it's interesting to speculate about. Alexander was getting a pretty grim image by now. So much so that even his heavy-duty propaganda is incapable of wiping it clean. It seems like he was getting more brutal, more impatient, and more paranoid. Or perhaps he felt that ruthlessness was simply necessary. The threat of insurrection was real enough. There would be uprisings in some of these recently founded garrison towns, and these too were met with horrific retributions. But as we said before, paranoia is self-fulfilling. Many of those around Alexander will have thought that it was a matter of time before it was their turn to be executed, so it might not be a bad idea to be one step ahead of them, of him. In Macedonia, we can imagine a certain Antipater becoming more than a bit worried. If even Parmenio wasn't spared, could he be expected to be rewarded for past favors? After the purges, the conquests continued. Bessos didn't make the chase easy. He burned everything in his path, so that it became harder for Alexander's troops to live off the land. But eventually, the satrap was betrayed, handed over, and put on a spike. If revenging Darius had really been the reason for carrying on, that should have been the end of it. It wasn't. As Alexander's march progressed, you began to see more and more cruelty. Even people who capitulated were not spared. But perhaps this was not just about power corrupting Alexander, the nature of the war was changing. By this point, he was no longer facing a mighty army that could be defeated, a state that could be taken over. Instead, it became an endless slog of guerrilla warfare. That was much more frustrating. The enemy was hiding, or posing as a friend or bystander. And even if you defeated one rebellion, you won neither riches nor glory, and often, others would spring up in its place. And like always with asymmetrical warfare, you either have to win hearts and minds, which is hard, or apply collective punishment. Alexander increasingly chose the latter. Perhaps also because he became frustrated with this low-intensity, low-reward sort of campaigning. In the West, Alexander's conquest is sometimes presented as a liberation of enslaved people, or as the spreading of a superior culture. But in Persia, and the area around it, he is remembered as the Demon King. Despite the mounting frustration, he continued on even beyond the limits of the old Persian realm, into what is today Pakistan. The Indian subcontinent was very divided at the time, as it had always been. More than one local ruler freely submitted to Alexander, but one of them, called Porus, resisted. He became one of Alexander's toughest opponents, partly because he used hundreds of war elephants. The Greeks had learned to deal with these beasts in smaller numbers, but they were unprepared for this sort of massive stampede. Many of their soldiers were trampled to death. But perhaps this was leveled out by the fact that the Indians in turn lacked armor. In the end, the Greeks again won the day, but it was already a sign of how warfare would change in the coming decades. As we saw last episode, Seleucus would win the War of the Dianicae, in large part thanks to the about 500 war elephants that he got in India. No military technology retains its superiority forever. People were starting to adapt to the phalanx and finding ways to disrupt it. Surprisingly, unlike others who had given Alexander a hard time, Porus was not punished. Instead, he remained in charge of his domain, now as a satrap. He even got to enlarge his domain as part of the arrangement. That must have been unpopular with the troops that saw their friends trampled by elephants, I imagine. Again, the march continued, but the difficulties continued to multiply as well. The terrain became even more difficult. Just think of the Indian jungle, with all those man-eating monsters that the Macedonians never saw before. The rainy season caused giant mud streams. You had alien diseases that the Greeks proved vulnerable to. And now imagine having to stay in close formation in that kind of an environment. It's astonishing that, despite the many casualties, Alexander could still keep going. It was only feasible because there was a constant stream of fresh recruits arriving from the west. And that, in turn, was only made possible due to the infrastructure that the Persian Empire had built. The Macedonians found many things they did not expect, but that which they hoped to find, they did not. Namely, the fabled riches that were associated with these unknown Indian lands. They didn't conclude that these were fake, however. They just thought, just a little further, it can't be far off now. A very human way to react, I suppose. All in all, I find it surprising how little impact, lasting impact, this first encounter between East and West had on both sides. Even the tales about the fantastic monsters that supposedly lived in India didn't become all that more realistic. In the end, Alexander was forced to go back. His men had had enough. And who could blame them? Just consider the sheer distance that they had covered. Imagine marching from Greece to Pakistan on what we would consider bad sandals, while carrying all this heavy equipment. Think of the battles, the infections, the wounds, now the snakes, the crocodiles, and the mosquitoes. They were exhausted, and there was no end in sight. For what was their purpose anymore now? What was the end goal? Sure, Alexander could add some more land to his kingdom, but how would the men ever pick the fruits of their efforts if they never stopped fighting? So in the end, they sort of went on strike, and Alexander reluctantly agreed to turn back. However, typically, instead of crossing through already pacified lands, in air quotes, he took another way back, which gave him the opportunity to conquer some more. A true power and adrenaline junkie, right? But for his men, this again proved challenging. Many died while crossing barren deserts, for instance. Along the way, the Greeks met up with their fleet, which they had deemed lost. As you can imagine, the marines also had fantastic tales to tell. For instance, of a giant sea monster that spat water out of its back. Just as they were getting ready to fight it, the cowardly whale swam off. Alexander spent his final days in Babylon, physically and mentally degenerating and scaring the crap out of almost anyone around him. It seems that the final drop in the bucket was the death of his closest friend, and according to rumors, his lover, Hephaestion. Here again, the similarities with the Iliad become too plain to ignore. In that story, Achilles, the hero of Greece, became mad with rage when his friend and cousin Patroclus was accidentally killed by Hector, the champion of the Trojans. His revenge would be terrible. So too was the reaction of Alexander. He suspected other barons of murdering Hephaestion, and who knows, maybe with reason. But the price was also paid by innocent peoples that happened to live close by. Hephaestion's funeral pyre was apparently even more spectacular than that for Patroclus in the Iliad, 200 by 200 meters in size and 80 meters high, all made of precious painted wood. Alexander made no secret of how much he adored Hephaestion, but what may also have upset him was that in the legend, as he very well knew, Achilles died shortly after his friend, and indeed there were prophecies foretelling how a curse would fall upon the king. This anecdote can easily have been constructed in hindsight, needless to say, but for what it's worth, Alexander allegedly took it seriously. An old man would be placed on the throne in his stead, if only for one day, and then be executed. The idea being that the curse would then fall on the decoy and not on the king himself. That was an ancient custom in Babylonia, so the idea may have been put in his head by the Babylonian priesthood. But the curse was not so easily fooled, it seems. For after yet another day of heavy drinking, Alexander was struck by a high fever and died as mysteriously as his friend. He was only 32 years old. There has been a ton of speculation about the cause of his death ever since. Alexander had relieved Antipater of his command in Macedon and summoned him to Babylon. When his son Cassander came to check whether the coast was clear, Alexander abused him. So both had good reasons to kill him. And coincidentally, of course, Cassander's brother, Antipater's other son, was the king's cupbearer who had access to his wine. So he may have killed him. Or perhaps it was an overdose of alcohol, food poisoning, exhaustion, or malaria. Now, there is something unsatisfying about all these hypotheses, I find. Alexander would have realized that Antipater and Cassander would perhaps want to murder him after such provocations. Then would he really have kept the same cupbearer? Why? Since we will never know what really happened, why not throw another hypothetical out there, just for the heck of it? What would be the best story in this case? Well, if I would make a movie out of this, I think I'm going to make it in the style of Jesus Christ Superstar. The protagonist needs to be betrayed in order to fulfill his destiny, and Cassander could be cast in the role of Judas Iscariot. In my mind's eye, Alexander is just sitting there in his palace in Babylon, drinking by himself, nostalgic and bitter. Up to that point, his life had been one great adventure, but he now came to realize his best days were probably behind him. He could certainly conquer more, but to what purpose? He had avenged his father, had avenged Greece. Payback can be a great motivator, but once you've achieved it, there's little satisfaction. Also, he used to be surrounded by childhood friends. Now, even if he challenged someone for some pointless drinking game, they would surely let him win. Where was the fun in that? When he looked around, he saw nothing but sycophants and people who hated and feared him. Even his soldiers had refused to follow him eventually. Ingrates! Were those the people that would inherit his kingdom? To hell with that! His destiny was to become immortal, and for that, he first had to die like Achilles before his time, a tragic hero's death. Then everything would fall apart, and everyone would know the reason, because the great king had ascended to a higher realm, watching his funeral games from above, and so he chose his own death. He provoked the Antipater and sons, and eagerly drank the poison, like Socrates. How fitting for a philosopher king. And besides, better to burn out than to fade away. It would hardly be further from the truth than Oliver Stone's movie about Alexander, so why not? But I don't believe that it actually occurred like that myself. For Alexander still had other plans. He wanted to invade Arabia, and then who knows what? And this points to a final question. How should we judge this guy? Was he unreasonably aggressive, driven forward by dreams of glory? Or were his motives more prosaic? Adrian Goldsworthy rightly points out that one of the things we have to consider in his favor is that maybe he didn't have much of a choice. Like Philip II also may not have had much of a choice. In Macedonia and Greece, if a city-state was not expanding, that was always seen as weakness. Had Philip not gone on the offensive, he would surely have been overthrown. Without spoils to share, his army and kingdom would have disintegrated and be swallowed whole by others. To keep new rewards flowing in, he had to keep picking new fights, and so did Alexander. If he didn't find outside enemies, his men would start fighting among themselves, as the near future would show. So perhaps, in a cynical sort of way, he had the right idea, to continue expanding. If you want peace, prepare for war. That's a saying from the ancient world, and perhaps it rings more true than we might like. Perhaps people in positions of leadership also cannot afford to have the same moral compass as the rest of us do. Then maybe the decision of Perdiccas to stop the war, maybe that was the big mistake, which led directly to the wars, the terrible wars of the Dyadochi. Now this is of course a very cynical way to look at it, and I sure hope there is a better way. In fact, I think there was a way out, at least by the end of Alexander's life. If he had then declared peace, No one would mistake that for weakness. He had won every battle he'd ever fought. There was no question that he was the strongest player in the game. Also, he now had all the money that the Persians had amassed over the centuries. Surely that would be enough, more than enough, to keep any patronage system running for generations to come. Most troops were satisfied with their generous rewards. Most veterans would probably rather enjoy the rest of their lives in peace instead of turning up for yet another dangerous campaign. Maybe he had this one chance to stop, to break the wheel. Perhaps it wouldn't have worked, but we'll never know now, because he just wasn't interested. What a waste. And I'll leave you with that. Thanks for listening. Small announcement, Spotify has provided a new way for me to communicate with you. You can still send me emails or chats on Facebook, but as I said before, there's always the risk I will mistake your message for spam, and that's a pity, for your feedback and encouragement means a lot to me. From now on, you can also reach out directly via Spotify. Just below the description of the episode, you'll find a Q&A, and I intend to use that for asking what you liked or didn't like about the show. Or perhaps I'll ask some more specific questions in time. I can't respond directly, of course, but if you'd like an answer, you can leave your email address in the message. Thanks again, and talk to you soon. Bye!